you know, there are certain phrases that are just completely baked into our cultural subconscious.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, patience is a virtue.
Yeah. You know,
we hear that from the time we're toddlers.
Oh, right. Right.
Or if you happen to run in spiritual or religious circles, the classic advice when you're going through a tough time is to just, you know, wait on the Lord.
Yeah, that is the ultimate spiritual bumper sticker. It sounds incredibly pious, doesn't it?
It really does.
It kind of conjures up this image of sitting quietly, hands folded, being very zen while the universe or God just sort of sorts everything out for you.
Exactly. It frames inactivity as a form of holiness. Like, if I just sit here and do nothing, I'm being faithful. But I was reading through this message today. It's a source titled, When Waiting Isn't Working, from a series called More Than a Name.
Mm-hmm.
And it hits you with a pretty jarring counterargument right out of the gate.
Yeah, it really flips the script on that whole idea, because the core argument here is that there were specific times where waiting on the Lord isn't faith at all. It's actually disobedience.
Which is, I mean, it's a little uncomfortable to hear if you're currently procrastinating on something and calling it, you know, waiting for a sign.
Guilt as charged. But the source material backs us up with a really fascinating deep dive into a specific narrative in the Bible. It's the story of the man born blind in John chapter 9.
Okay.
And what I love about this analysis is that it takes a story many people think they know, right? Like a Sunday school classic.
Oh, yeah. Cobra.
But it zooms in on the gritty, messy details to find a concept the source calls muddy moves.
Muddy moves. I love that phrasing. It sounds messy.
It is messy. It's all about taking action in the midst of imperfection.
Okay, so let's set the scene for the listener before we unpack that concept. We're in Jerusalem. You've got Jesus walking with his disciples, and they come across a man who has been blind since birth.
Right.
Now, you'd think the immediate reaction from a group of religious students would be compassion, maybe asking, how can we help?
You would hope so. But the disciples, being the eternal students and intellectuals that they are, they see this guy not as a suffering person, but as a theological puzzle.
Yeah.
They immediately ask Jesus, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?
Such a cold question. It's like they're standing right in front of him, talking about him like he's an object or a case study.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's troubleshoot the karma here.
It is theological troubleshooting. And the source points out how dangerous that is. We see a problem, and our instinct is to debate the cause rather than help with the solution.
Mm.
They want to solve the riddle of the blindness. They aren't interested in the blind man himself. It's a massive distraction.
And Jesus shuts that down immediately. He's not having it.
He really isn't. He basically says, wrong question. He tells them neither the man nor his parents sinned. Mm-hmm. He shifts the focus entirely from why did this happen to what is God going to do with it?
Wow.
The source calls this the shift from debate to display. The disciples wanted a theological debate, but Jesus wanted a display of power.
And to get that display, this is the part of the story that always surprises me. No matter how many times I hear it, things get weird.
They get very weird.
Because Jesus doesn't just say, be healed. He doesn't just wave his hand.
No, he gets tactile. And honestly, a little offensive by modern standards.
He literally spits on the ground.
Right into the dirt.
He makes mud with the saliva in the dirt.
Yeah.
And then he takes that mud and smears it directly onto the blind man's eyes.
Just pause and think about the visceral nature of that for a second. In the ancient world, saliva wasn't exactly seen as medicinal in this context. And dirt is, well, dirt.
Yeah.
He is taking a man who already has a major problem, blindness, and literally rubbing dirt in it.
Talk about adding insult to injury. If I'm that guy, I'm thinking, okay, great. I was blind and now I'm blind with mud on my face. Thanks a lot.
Right.
But there's a method to the madness, right? This leads us to that core concept of the muddy move.
Exactly. Because here is the kicker. Jesus doesn't heal him right there. He puts the mud on his face and then gives him a command. He says, go, wash in the pool of Siloam.
Which, as the source notes, translates to sent. So there is a very clear mission involved.
Right. So here is the muddy move defined by our source. It's when you are in a mess, you can't see the outcome. Literally, this guy is blind and now has mud caked on his eyelids. But God gives you an instruction to move anyway.
And this is where the waiting is disobedience part really kicks in. Because if that man had stood there with mud on his face and said, I'm just going to wait right here for God to heal me, he would have stayed blind.
Precisely. That is the crucial insight of this whole analysis. The healing wasn't in the mud itself. The healing was in the washing.
Mm-hmm.
And to wash, he had to move. He had to navigate the streets of Jerusalem, blind, looking ridiculous with mud on his face, tapping his cane, bumping into walls, all to get to this pool.
That's a long walk and a pretty humiliating one.
It is. And that's the tension the source wants us to sit with. We usually want the healing before we move. We want the clarity before we take the step. We want the whole strategy laid out in a PowerPoint deck before we commit.
Right. Give me the 5-year plan first.
Exactly. But in this story, the movement creates the miracle.
So if movement is the key, why do we stay stuck? Why do we just stand there with the mud drying on our faces? The source outlines 3 specific traps that keep us in waiting mode when we should be in washing mode.
Yeah.
And the first one is... well, it's one I think everyone struggles with. Trap number 1, waiting on perfect.
Oh, the paralysis of perfectionism. It's the absolute enemy of progress.
The source points out the profound irony here. We usually feel like conditions need to be perfect for us to act or for God to move in our lives. We want the stars to align, the bank account to be full, the mood to be just right.
Mm-hmm.
But look at the materials Jesus used here.
Dirt and spit. You literally cannot get more basic or less holy sounding than mud. The source argues that Jesus used the most common, unsterile, imperfect substance imaginable to perform a miracle.
Yeah.
He didn't need a sterile hospital room. He didn't need a surgical team. He used the ground.
It's a great reminder that God doesn't need our situation to be polished to work within it. But the source takes this idea of waiting on perfect and applies it specifically to something that trips a lot of people up.
Which is?
Community. Specifically, finding a church.
Oh, yeah. This part made me laugh because it is so incredibly true. The author says, if you find the perfect church, don't join it because you will mess it up.
Harsh, but fair. As soon as I walk in the door, there goes the neighborhood.
Exactly. It cuts right through that consumer mindset we all have. We look for the perfect community, the perfect job, the perfect partner. The source uses the metaphor of the bride of Christ for the church. People say, I don't want to go to church. There are hypocrites there. The bride has mud on her dress.
And the counter argument from the source is essentially, yeah, she does. That's why she's there.
Right. The source references Ephesians 5, noting that we don't clean ourselves up to be presentable to Jesus. Jesus does the cleaning. He washes the bride. If you are waiting for a community that has no issues, you're waiting for a fantasy.
You're waiting for a museum, not a hospital.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And it extends to marriage, too. The source mentions that we need to stop waiting for our relationships to be perfect and realize they are just a beautiful mess.
Beautiful mess is the right phrase. The advice here is to swap your expectation of perfection for an appreciation of proximity. Just being present.
Yes.
If you wait for your marriage to be flawless before you commit to working on it, or your job to be perfect before you give it your best effort, you're missing the point. Jesus specializes in mud.
Mm. Jesus specializes in mud. That is such a relieving thought. It takes all the pressure off. You don't have to present a polished version of yourself to get started.
Right. You don't need a filtered Instagram life for God to use you.
No, you just have to present your messy self and be willing to move.
Okay, so that's trap 1, waiting on perfect. Trap 2 strikes me as a bit more psychological and honestly a bit deeper. It's waiting on people.
This is where we have to get into the head of the blind man a little bit. The source posits a theory about why Jesus used the mud. Like, he's God. He could have just snapped his fingers. Why the theatrics? Why the mess?
Why make it so gritty?
The theory is discomfort.
Interesting. So the mud wasn't just a vehicle for power, it was an irritant.
Think about it. Having drying mud caked over your eyelids is irritating. It's itchy, it's heavy, it crumbles. The source suggests that if the man had been comfortable, he might not have felt the urgency to go to the pool.
Oh, wow. If he had just stayed blind but comfortable, he might have stayed on that street corner forever.
Exactly. The mud forced the issue. It made staying put absolutely unbearable. But there's another layer to this waiting on people idea. Why send him to the pool of Siloam? Why separate him from the crowd?
The source mentions getting him away from his neighbors, right?
Right. The people who sat next to him every single day. The people who knew him only as the blind beggar.
That is a heavy label. When everyone around you sees you a certain way, it's really hard to see yourself differently. You just become the character they expect you to be.
It's the soft bigotry of low expectations. To his neighbors, he was a fixture of the street corner, not a person with potential. If Jesus had healed him right there, amidst the debate of who sinned, the man would have still been surrounded by those voices.
Right.
He would have been healed physically, but socially, he might have still been trapped.
So the walk to the pool was about separation. It was about breaking out of the echo chamber.
Physical and mental separation. And here is the insight from the source that I found the most profound. It's about the reflection.
Oh, right. This part gave me chills. It's such a cinematic image.
So visualize this. The man walks to the pool. He washes the mud off. Now, Siloam was a pool of water shining in the sun. When the water settles and he opens his eyes for the very first time in his life, what is the first thing he sees?
He's leaning over the water so he sees himself.
He sees his own face. Not the darkness he was born with, not the pitying looks of the neighbors. He sees himself as a new creation.
Wow.
The source argues that this journey was about stripping away the labels placed by others. Before he could see Jesus, he needed to see his true self, a child of God.
That is a massive perspective shift, an identity shift. If he had waited on the people, waited for their permission or their validation, he never would have left the street corner.
He had to walk away from the voices that labeled him to find the voice that healed him. The source warns us that if you wait for people to validate your change, you will stay blind. You cannot wait for the crowd to applaud your transformation before you start it.
And the source actually gives some really gritty, real-world examples of what these muddy moves look like when you stop waiting on people. It mentions observations from 13 years of ministry, things that just don't make sense on paper.
Like couples starting marriage counseling right in the middle of a divorce filing.
Which sounds crazy. Everyone around them is probably saying, it's over, move on.
It sounds like too little, too late to the neighbors, but it's a muddy move. It's an act of obedience in the middle of a disaster. They aren't waiting for approval. They are washing the mud.
Or people tithing, giving money right in the middle of a job loss.
That is the definition of counterintuitive. Logic and people say, hoard what you have, protect yourself. Faith says, trust and move.
And the last one mentioned was turning to Jesus in the middle of shame and regret. Not waiting until you fixed your life or cleaned up your act to come to God, but coming to Him while you still feel the dirt.
That is the essence of it. We often think, I need to get cleaned up before I go to the pool. But the command is to go to the pool to get cleaned up. The mud is part of the process.
So we've got waiting on perfect and waiting on people. The third trap, honestly, this one is the hardest for me. It's waiting on pain-free.
Yeah. This one requires us to zoom out a bit and look at the context of the chapter. Because stories in the Bible don't happen in a vacuum. The source points out something I hadn't really connected before. Do you know what happens immediately before this story in John chapter 9?
Well, it follows John 8, obviously. But refresh my memory on the action there.
So in John 8, Jesus is in the temple. He gets into a heated argument with the religious leaders, and he makes this massive claim. He says, before Abraham was, I am. He claims absolute divinity.
And I'm guessing that didn't go over well with the establishment.
Understatement of the year. The text says the people picked up stones to kill him. This isn't just an argument. This is a lynch mob. Jesus has to hide himself and slip away from the temple grounds to avoid being stoned to death.
So his adrenaline is pumping. This is a life or death scenario. He is literally fleeing.
He is a fugitive in that moment, and yet in John 9.1, as he is passing by, fleeing this absolute danger, he stops to notice the blind man.
That is wild. Most of us, if we're running for our lives, we aren't stopping to do charity work. We're looking for the exit.
We aren't even noticing other people. We are entirely in survival mode. But Jesus stops. He didn't wait for a safe moment to do good. He didn't wait for the threat to vanish. He ministered in the middle of the danger.
He didn't wait for a pain-free environment.
Exactly. And the lesson the source draws here is incredibly stark. We often tell ourselves, I'll obey God when my anxiety is gone, or I'll start that ministry when my credit score is fixed.
I'll be generous when I'm finally out of debt.
Right. We wait for the pain to stop before we start to live. We treat our problems like pause buttons.
But the source argues that Jesus doesn't always take the pain away before he asks us to move. Sometimes the miracle happens during the difficulty, not after it.
This brings up the thorn in the flesh concept, doesn't it? The source references the Apostle Paul.
It does. In 2 Corinthians, Paul talks about this thorn, and scholars have debated for centuries what it was. Bad eyesight, malaria, a specific enemy, we don't really know.
But we know it was painful.
Very. And Paul prayed 3 times for the Lord to take it away.
He wanted the pain-free option. He wanted the problem deleted.
Don't we all? But the answer wasn't, okay, sure, let me fix that for you.
The answer was, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness.
That phrase, made perfect in weakness, that loops us all the way back to trap 1, doesn't it? We want perfection. God wants our weakness, because that's the canvas for his power.
The source draws a really vital distinction here between taking away and making a way.
That is a key nugget. We pray for God to take away the obstacle. But often, God's plan is to make a way through the obstacle.
Yes.
If Paul had waited for his thorn to be removed before he started preaching, we wouldn't have most of the New Testament.
And if the blind man had waited for his eyes to feel better before walking to the pool, he never would have arrived. He had to walk while it hurt.
I love the specific phrasing the source uses regarding grace here. It really struck a chord with me. It says, grace isn't a lump sum. It's just enough for today and enough for next Tuesday.
That is a beautiful way to put it. We obsess over whether we'll have the strength to handle this problem for the next 10 years. We catastrophize.
Oh, constantly.
But that's not how grace works. It's manna. It's daily bread. It isn't about having a stockpile of strength. It's about having enough for the battle you're fighting right now.
Enough for next Tuesday. That's going to stick with me. It really challenges the idea that a blessed life is an easy life. We think if things are hard, we must be doing something wrong.
Completely. But in this story, the blessing wasn't the absence of mud. The blessing was found in the movement through the mud.
So to recap the journey here, because this really is a roadmap for anyone listening who feels stuck, whether it's spiritually, professionally, or relationally. We start with a blind man, a bit of spit, and some dirt. We've got the disciples trying to debate theology while Jesus is trying to display power.
And the man is faced with a binary choice. Stay still and wait, which feels safe, feels holy, feels like what everyone else is doing, or make a muddy move.
And we identify the three traps that stop us from making that move.
Okay.
Trap one, waiting on one day.
Perfect. Thinking you need a perfect church, a perfect marriage, or a perfect life before you can engage.
But remembering that Jesus creates progress out of proximity, not perfection, you just have to show up. You have to bring your muddy self to the table. Trap two, waiting on people. Letting the neighbors label you as the beggar instead of stepping away to see yourself as a child of God.
And realizing that sometimes the mud is there to make you uncomfortable enough to leave those toxic environments. The discomfort is a gift if it gets you moving.
And trap three, waiting on pain-free. Thinking you can't serve God or make a change until the anxiety, the debt, or the struggle is completely gone.
When in reality, his grace is sufficient for the chaos you're in right now. You don't need a pain-free life to have a purpose-filled life.
It all comes down to that distinction you mentioned earlier, hearing versus doing.
That is the final call to action from the source. It says, hearing the word of the Lord doesn't save you. It's when you do the word of the Lord that healing and redemption comes. The man heard Jesus say, go wash, but the hearing didn't heal him.
Only the washing did.
You can sit in church or listen to deep dives like this one all day long and nod your head at the insights. You can highlight the quotes in the book. But until you actually walk to the pool, the mud stays on your face.
And you stay blind. The transformation is always in the application.
Always.
So here is the thought we want to leave you with today. It's a bit of a provocation based on what we've just unpacked.
We established that Jesus intentionally applied the mud. He created a mess to create a miracle.
So look at your life right now. Look at the thing that is frustrating you the most, the mess, the discomfort. The thing you've been praying for, God did just magically poof away.
Ask yourself this. What if that mess isn't an obstacle? What if it's a catalyst?
If Jesus put the mud there to force the man to move toward the pool, what muddy move is your current mess trying to push you toward?
Are you waiting for it to clear up or are you washing it off?
Something to chew on. Thanks for diving in with us.
Ideally while moving.
We'll catch you in the next deep dive.